Thousands in South Florida are going to sleep hungry. How can we change that? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. According to the nonprofit Feeding South Florida, roughly 10% of the region is food insecure. That means there are thousands of people not getting enough nutrition in a day. We're going to meet the CEO of the nonprofit to talk about their plans for trying to end hunger, close out food deserts, and end the stigma with being someone in need. Also, Peter Sagal tackles politics in his comedy as host of the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But why is Sagal always on the run?
When you run, you're doing something that you literally evolve to do. You're actually not learning something new so much as returning to something that you knew but forgot.
We spoke to Sagal back when he came to the Miami Book Fair. His new book is called The Incomplete Book of Running. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, this holiday season, thousands of families in South Florida will be going to sleep hungry. According to the nonprofit organization Feeding South Florida's annual count, more than 700,000 people are currently food insecure in the region. For nearly 40 years, the Feeding South Florida group has partnered with schools, churches, and other groups to deliver meals to families in need. Paco Velez is the president and CEO of the organization, and he explains where are the greatest needs and why the winter months, not always the busiest months, but still a big need as we approach into the holiday season. Paco, thank you so much. I really appreciate the time.
We appreciate you guys having us. Thank you.
I also want to note, just so people know, Feeding South Florida has partnered with WLRN during the last several membership campaigns. Time and again, listeners have chosen to provide meals to the food insecure in the community more than any other thank you gift. And WLRN continues to partner with Feeding South Florida again during this winter membership campaign. Paco, I want to start with this. Define food insecurity so we know exactly what that means.
Sure. Well, first of all, I want to thank WLRN. You guys have been a fantastic partner and a membership providing over 94,000 meals to families struggling here in South Florida from Palm Beach down to the Keys. So food insecurity for us, it's lingo that food banks use to define when a family or an individual doesn't know from where they will get their next meal. When we look at hunger is a state of being at a certain time. If someone doesn't eat breakfast, they may be hungry until they get to lunch. Doesn't mean they cannot afford the breakfast or cannot afford the lunch. They're just hungry at that time. Versus food insecurity, they don't know where they're going to get their meals or their groceries in order to feed their families and their children.
And so, you know, also, I mean, when we're talking about food insecurity, does that also include people who are on food stamps, live in homeless shelters, or anything like that? Or are you counting these people differently?
No, we're counting folks that are struggling altogether. The amount of homeless that we serve is really less than 1% of the entire population that we're serving. The majority of the individuals that we serve are working families, working individuals that have children in their households, over 240,000 children in these households that we serve, as well as over 100,000 older adults that are struggling with food insecurity. Overall, it's like you said, over 700,000 individuals in the four county area. Less than 7,000 of those are the homeless population.
700,000 people in our region. That's more, a little more than 10% of the population of South Florida.
It's really high. We're in a very we're in a great area, paradise for most, but we are also in the service industry. A lot of hospitality, a lot of restaurants and hotels, and a lot of low wage paying jobs. Plus, the cost of living down here just continues to go up. So it's really that gap of what people make versus what people have to spend in order to live and play here, or I say play, but really live and survive here in South Florida.
And how are you tracking those communities? I mean, or where these folks are you know, where they're living and the ones who are food insecure?
So we have we go through a gap analysis. There's a lot of great data out there. We've also just acquired a great client management software where we can look at where the biggest need is. But we're looking at pockets of poverty, pockets of what the census tracks as the income levels, poverty, age groups, and finding out, do we have enough services there? Are enough people accessing free breakfast, free lunch, and those are for the kids at school? Are folks accessing food stamps or SNAP benefits? Are they accessing Medicaid? Do they have any senior or older adult programs in that area? So we target some of those areas based on census and based on our partner agencies.
How are you reaching these people? Is it just about, you know, having the pantries where people can come, or are you getting out to different groups? Because you're also partnering, as I mentioned, with schools, churches, different organizations.
Correct. So we have the great privilege of working with about 305 different nonprofit organizations in the four county area. And they are embedded in the community and work with the trusted source in those areas for families. So we work with churches. We also work with Salvation Armies, Camilla's House, places like that, that are really trusted in the community. Families come to those organizations, and we provide the food for those organizations to make sure that they have enough to be able to serve the families in the area. They provide us with reports, and we're able to look at those reports and really get a better understanding of the need, either in those zip codes, those census tracts, or even deeper in those block areas.
You know, since you started Feeding South Florida, I've wondered, are things getting better or worse?
That's a very interesting question. So in 1981 is when Feeding South Florida started. It was the Daily Bread Food Bank. I've been here since 2012. And although we've seen the number of individuals decrease from almost 1 million to about 700,000, the actual need in those families has increased, which the meal gap. So we call it Map the Meal Gap with Feeding America. And it's just the cost of living versus the rate of pay has increased that gap that folks aren't able to fill. And with especially you mentioned the certain seasons are greater than others. For us, it's those summer months when kids are home from school, not getting that free breakfast, free lunch. That gap increases, so we're seeing a bigger gap in those families. So the amount of need increases for those 700,000 individuals than across the entire county.
I want to get a sense of where the need is greatest. And you think about South Florida. I mean, from Palm Beach County down to the Keys, very diverse community. Now Miami, especially, it's a Latino community, and you have a lot of immigrants here. But where do you see the greatest need? Where are these folks at? Who are they?
It's interesting that you say that, because you can't really see the faces are just like everybody else's faces. And when we bring in the Youth Ambassador Program, and parents come in with their children, elementary school children, so they can learn more about hunger and are very interested about hunger and want to take it back to their schools, it is then when their parents realize that their children is asking for extra food at lunch so they can help one of their
take
friends.
Well,
so they
help
can
their friends.
Help their friends at school, and their parents are one, proud, but also shocked that that's an issue, because they don't really see it. And it's the same thing anywhere we go. Miami, you mentioned, is such a very diverse place that in these neighborhoods you'll see a lot of wealth, and in those same neighborhoods you'll see extreme poverty, side by side. Whereas in other areas you'll see. In Belgrade is predominantly low income, and then the island is predominantly high income.
Right.
It just changes here in Miami, where it's just all over the place, and you'll have other areas, bigger pockets like Overtown and Liberty City.
Again, we're talking with Paco Velez, he's CEO and president of Feeding South Florida. We're discussing the challenges of trying to help people in need, and we're learning that there are a lot of people who are food insecure. Now, we're going to continue this conversation in a moment. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN during this winter membership campaign. Thank you again for your support. Well, let's return to our conversation with Paco Velez. He's the CEO and president of Feeding South Florida, and we're talking about the number of people in South Florida who are food insecure and the best ways we can try to help them. You know, actually, Paco, I wanted to ask you, what inspires you? What is it that drives you? And you spent so many years now trying to help feed so many people.
So it's... A long time ago, I was grew up in Texas, on the border, in the border town, and was always involved in service. Really, it was it altar boy serving the altars, serving the church. Same thing when I was growing up in high school, in customer service in some of the retail stores. And it really didn't dawn on me until much later in life that this is really what I want to do. Is I want to serve my community, serve my neighborhood, serve folks that really could use the help. And so I get the question all the time, or I get the statement, your work must be very rewarding, and you must go home and feel good about what you've done. And when you go to a distribution, we have dozens and dozens of distributions every single week, distributed 50 million pounds of food just last year alone to the over 700,000 individuals. You go to a distribution and you see the child, or you see the senior, you see the family excited about getting fresh produce, excited about getting food for the week. But it quickly dissipates. You realize that there's so much more that has to be done, so much more that we can do around helping families with different life skills and maybe in workforce development, which is what Feeding South Florida is getting into. So this just what drives me is making sure that our children, our families, our seniors have food on the table to continue to live.
One of the challenges that you have is the stigma around people in need, whether it's students who have to have the free or reduced lunch, people who have to go to a pantry to get help. It's that stigma, and people feel shame. How do you fight that? Part of it has to be in helping them get over it, but also helping other people understand this, you know, there's no shame in this at all. And if somebody needs help, they need help.
So we're seeing families at some of their worst times in their lives, having to realize or come to the realization that they cannot put food on the table, keep the lights on, keep the car going all at the same time, and coming in and really having to just say, I need help. It's not really easy for anybody to do, especially for families who are struggling with a basic need, which is food. So we do a lot of publicity, a lot of interviews, and we talk to a lot of volunteers. We talk to anyone we can about the needs in the community and try to dispel those myths about the needs in the community. And it really is majority of the individuals or families we serve are working families, or the seniors that have already worked and are on either Social Security or on disability or both. And so it's trying to dispel some of those myths.
One of the other things I find fascinating and shocking is the fact that we have food deserts. This is, as you said, paradise. And it's a service industry area, and there's food everywhere. But how do we have food deserts, and how are you dealing with that challenge?
It is a paradise, and we have restaurants everywhere.
And by the way, define that real quickly, just in case, the food desert.
Sure. Food desert is an area where folks don't have access to a grocery store, but more importantly, fresh produce and healthy items. And what a lot of people don't know, even folks that live here in South Florida, is that Palm Beach and Miami-Dade are two of the biggest agricultural counties in the United States. Definitely this side of the Mississippi, Palm Beach County by far is the largest agricultural county in southeastern United States. Even then, it's still difficult to get food from where it is and those who have it onto the table of those who need it because of either the cost, the accessibility, which is the food desert comes in. So what we tell people is those folks that are helping us put food on everyone else's table are struggling to put food on their own table. Miami-Dade is over $1 billion industry in the agricultural. Palm Beach County is almost a $2 billion industry in agriculture. So we have the food.
And you have a relationship you've been trying to build with farmers. Because, you know, you're trying to get that food there. One of the interesting things, too, is the fact that some people may know this, maybe they don't, but there's a lot of food they grow that gets tossed out, and you're trying to get that food.
Right. So there's a couple of things. The first is the produce that doesn't look the way you think it's supposed to look.
It has to look very attractive for the stores to buy it.
Right.
Yes.
So if you can imagine a zucchini that's about 2.5, maybe 3 feet long, and each zucchini weighs about 5-7 pounds. Those are the zucchinis that we get at Feeding South Florida compared to the little small ones that look like a hot dog that folks will see at the store. So we get the ones that are cosmetically different. Now, nothing wrong with them, still delicious, still very, very fresh. They come off the coal line, and the coal line is where the produce goes down a conveyor belt. Things that don't look like they can sell at market or don't look cosmetically correct, we'll get that. The other produce that goes to waste is the one that just gets tilled back into the soil. And so we work with the growers or the farmers to use their labor force, reimburse them for that labor force, make sure they're getting paid, and then rescue that produce from the fields.
Right now, because I mentioned earlier, is that, you know, we're going into the winter holiday, and, I mean, this is the time people feel like giving. But this isn't the busiest time for you. It's actually summertime.
Correct. So summertime is really when everything really hits our families. So you look at utility bills going up because it's so hot here in South Florida. So air conditioners going or fans are going or something's going in their homes. You have the cost of fuel starts going up, and as well as the evaporation of that fuel, which is why they ask people to fuel up in the evening rather during the daytime because of that evaporation. The other part is kids are home from school. So they're no longer getting their free breakfast at school or free lunch at school. So now the family has to provide those meals for the kids. And in some cases, our families have to pay for daycare or some sort of child care for that. So there's a lot of expense for our families and really not a lot of assistance during the summer months, especially when produce season goes away.
So how can people help you out during the holiday season?
So for us, it's really a big logistical challenge right now. It's how do we get food from those who have it on and under the tables of those who need it? We have a fleet of about 20 trucks, 20 drivers. It's about rescuing food, getting it not only from South Florida, but we also work with our sister food banks across the state and across the country to bring it in. It's about paying that transportation.
Paco Vella, CEO and President of Feeding South Florida. Again, WLRN partnering with Feeding South Florida during the last several membership campaigns and doing it still again for this winter membership campaign. Paco, it's been a pleasure, man. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, still to come, Peter Sagal, known by many as the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but he's also an avid runner, and that's the subject of his new book. We're going to hear from him coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, you hear him every weekend on WLRN as the quick-witted host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Peter Sagal was in Miami during the Miami Book Fair to talk about his latest book, The Incomplete Book of Running. Sagal became a serious runner in his 40s, and he's run 14 marathons, 14 more than me. He joined us to talk about what running does for him, why he doesn't use headphones when he runs, and, of course, dealing with the issue of aging. And he talked about all kinds of things, how he puts his show together, of course, lots of running, and he's got some interesting hobbies.
Well, when I was younger, it was a way of working out the extraordinary anxiety I felt waking up as a nerd in a world that was not then friendly to nerds. And I want to say to nerds today, you have no idea how good you have it, because now it's cool. Now you like you can cosplay as Gandalf at high school and nobody will beat you up. I mean, this is a brave new world. But in my day, you know, just my interests and my enthusiasms and my skills, let's just say, were not appreciated by my high school peer group. And that led to a great deal of anxiety and discomfort and general unhappiness. And what I found was that by running, I handled some of them, my sort of lack of physical self-esteem. I lost weight, I felt better. But it was just also a way of just getting out and getting out of my head, which then and now is a dangerous place to spend all of my time.
You've spoken on numerous panels with folks who said that when they were younger, they were overweight, so running in part was seen as a way to overcome that. But yeah. I'm wondering, how much of running is about shaping your own self-image, your sense of identity, versus being part of a community?
You run because you need to get away from where you are, what you're doing. And you feel like, well, I just need to get away from all this and be by myself. But what you find, I have found in my life, is actually a community of other people, which is actually more comforting and helpful and healthy than the isolation you thought you were going to get by going out for a run.
Is it in any form running a meditation?
And
do you have to do that alone?
Well, that's true. I mean, I emphasize the importance of finding a group to run with. It's something that people don't think is what they're looking for. I think it is. When you find it, you'll know. At the same time, though, I mean, not all of your runs are going to be in a group. For me, for example, very typically, I tend to run on the weekends with my group and then by myself during the week. And when I'm running by myself, I have found that it's important not to put in headphones, which has gotten me into some trouble by saying this, because people are like, what do you mean? How can I keep up with my podcast? It's my only time. I love it. Or other people say, well, I can't spend that much time alone in my own head. To which I say, contrary to what I said a little while ago, yes, you should. We live in an age in which people are constantly piping input into their brains, usually through screens. If not through a screen, through your ears. People are probably listening to this right now while they're doing something. And the people who are listening to this right now, whatever they may be doing, couldn't ever imagine enduring silence while they're driving, say, or doing tasks around the home or office. And that's fine. I do that too. But if you didn't take out your headphones and get away from a screen, when you go for a run, you'd never have a minute during the day in which you weren't inputting something. And I don't think that's good for any of us.
But when you're running, I think it's interesting too, is when you're running is that you start to listen to things you don't pay attention to. Your heartbeat, you'll hear it in your ear. You start to hear sounds and noises you never thought of.
Right.
Which is kind of fascinating in itself.
It's amazing how much we are tuned out without knowing it. It's amazing how much we don't pay attention. If you've ever met somebody who has to endure, for whatever reason, a regular noise, say a train going by if they live near a train track, or traffic if they live near the highway, and you walk into their home and you say, wow, how can you stand the noise? And they say, what noise? Because they've gotten used to it and they've tuned it out. And all of us have done that to everything to an amazing extent, that we all just have become so closed off from the world around us, which is particularly weird to me coming to a place like Miami, which is in this extraordinary natural environment, which is both gorgeous and weird. And I walk around Miami and it feels like, you know, this bizarre city of the future. And there's like a lot to see here. And yet everybody who I saw on the street walking over was deep in conversation with somebody, be it a podcaster or a musician or a friend of theirs, and nobody was looking up.
I'm wondering about the correlations you have between your professional life, you know, hosting the show, and then this passion for running. Is everything connected, or do you try to separate them?
Well, I try to separate them. I mean, it's a lot of people have been listening to me in the radio for literally two decades, and they say to me, I didn't know you were a runner, and that's because I never talk about it, because no one wants to hear about running. And in a weird way, it's not that they're connected, although obviously when I go for a run, I think about the show. Sometimes I think about good jokes. Sometimes I come up with an idea. But more to the point, you know, I have a job where I have to sit and think all day and try to read things and understand them. And I'm just in my head. Somebody once said that all of us work manipulating symbols now, which is an interesting way of thinking about the fact that we're all stuck in front of screens. So for me, the time that I run is actually valuable because it's a break from all that. It's when I can actually get out of my head, a theme I return to, and get into my body. For most of us, sadly, in, you know, 21st century America, our bodies are things that take us from, you know, take our heads from screen to meal to larger screen to bed, and we don't do anything else with them. And I think that's a mistake. There's something about running, though, that I think is preferable because it's so natural. I mean, if you go to the gym and you do CrossFit, that's great. I think CrossFit is wonderful, but you're doing a lot of unnatural things. I mean, you're picking up weights and you're manipulating objects, and that's great. When you run, you're doing something that you literally evolved to do. You're actually not learning something new so much as returning to something that you knew but forgot. When you're a child, if you see a child, what are they doing for fun? They're running around. We all used to do that, and then we all got it beaten out of us. And I am like, get back to that. Run around shrieking a little bit.
You got back into running a lot in your 40s.
Yes,
and so now
when I turned 40, exactly.
Here's the interesting point then. I think about, you know, people in that age. I'm now in that age in my mid-40s. And you think about that and you're like, oh, I missed it. But I'm old. And
so?
I'm overweight. And I'm just, yeah. What do you tell people when they're like, yeah, I miss it, but?
I tell people that we all have a habit of comparing ourselves to artificial standards. Part of this is due to the culture. You know, to us, runners, athletes, fit people are almost another species. There they are glowing on the Soloflex ads on TV or on the cover of the magazines in airports. And we look at that and we say, well, that's not us. That's somebody else. In a weird way, it's a little bit like when we were all kids and found out, I'm speaking from personal experience, we weren't that good at baseball. So we were told, you're not a baseball player. We're kind of told by the culture, well, you're not an athlete. You're not somebody who's capable of being fit or of exercising or of any activity. And of course, the great thing about running is anybody can do it. So you can be a runner. So if you think you're overweight, if you think you're out of shape, that's fine. You go out there and you run to the extent and capacity and speed that you can. And if you keep it up, two things will happen. First, you'll probably become more in shape and lose a little weight. And secondly, even if you don't, it's fine. You're still out there running.
I thought one of the interesting parts of the book was when you hit this point where you're wondering, wait a second, is everything downhill from here?
Yes.
Or am I going to be able to improve my time? Is there a plateau? And you challenged yourself.
I did. Yeah, that was, I mean, it was quite literally sitting around. I ran a very nice marathon at the age of 41. And then the next few years, my marathon times, I ran one or two every year, decreased just a few minutes every time. Everything else was the same, but I just got a little slower. And it turns out that that is a scientifically described progression. People have researched it. Yes, you lose a minute or two per marathon time, all other things being equal, every year. So I said, that's sad. That means my best days are literally behind me. I don't want that to be true. So I put in a tremendous amount of effort. In fact, I say if I managed to put that much effort and discipline into anything else right now, I'd have a Nobel Prize. And I ran a marathon much quicker than I ever had before at the age of 46. And then it's been a decline since then. But still, I didn't stop time. I paused it. So what I would say to you or anybody, if you're 50, if you're 60, and you feel it's too late for what? Yes, you probably won't win a race. I have never won a race. Nobody wins races. That's not why you do it. You go out there to get the benefits, which involve exercise, mental freedom, simply being aware of your surroundings. The benefits are tremendous.
Yeah, Peter, it's not too late, I know, but you're right. I am definitely not going to be winning any races. Again, you've been listening to an earlier conversation that we had with a host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Peter Sagal. He was here for the Miami Book Fair last month, and we were talking about his book, The Incomplete Book of Running. We're going to come back momentarily with more from Peter Sagal. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks again for joining us. Now, let's get back to our conversation with the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, Peter Sagal. Sagal was in Miami for the Miami Book Fair, and he's out with his new book, The Incomplete Book of Running. Sagal's a passionate runner. He's competed in 14 marathons. Now, we started this part of the conversation, though, with a look at the popular NPR News quiz show and their approach to political satire under the Trump administration.
It is very, very different than it used to be in what I think of as the before times. In those days, we used to make fun of prominent politicians by taking some aspect of their personality and exaggerating it. So sometimes Hillary seemed a little bit entitled. So we would make jokes like, and Hillary Clinton, her program is, what is wrong with you people? I mean, you know, that's a joke. That's an exaggeration. We used to make fun of, say, Marco Rubio, your senator here in Florida. Like we said that after each debate during the 2016 election, his staff would strap him into the car seat and go off to the next thing. But, you know, it was a front-facing car seat, okay? It's not that bad. And you can make those jokes because they are exaggerations of minor traits. Hillary seems a little entitled. Marco Rubio seems a little young. The problem with Trump is everything he does is already so extraordinarily exaggerated. There's nothing to do with it. You just can't. I mean, he stood on a stage in front of live television cameras and bragged about the size of his genitalia. And that, what do you do? So that's a challenge of coming up with some way to point out his human foibles in a way that's original and not repetitive because he does the same things over and over and over and over. But it's also a challenge to know what our audience wants. Our audience wants us to make fun of Donald Trump because he causes most of our audience great, let's say, anxiety. And us saying things about him on the radio makes them feel better. But they also want to forget about him and everything for a little while. So every week we put together our show. We did it again this week. We say to ourselves, what are we going to talk about? What's the central thing we can say that will get it? Of all the crazy things that happened this week, what's the most important one to make some jokes about, to bring up, to talk about? And then when do we let it go and start talking about our usual topic of people stuffing chickens in their pants, silly studies, other dumbass things? Because people need that too.
Yeah. Let me finish with this. Is I come back to running. Is do you ever think about or worry about the day you can't run anymore?
I address that in the very end of the book because, you know, it comes for all of us. And I know a lot of people who tell me, I used to run, but my knees gave out. I used to run, but my hips, or I used to run, but arthritis. I've come close to it. I was hit by a car once, and fortunately I was able to walk away from that eventually. And I think about that, and what I hope I will do, if circumstances arise that I can no longer run, my legs, my hips, whatever give out, I will still find something to do that gets me outside, gets me moving, and gives me a time away from everything else.
And again, that is Peter Sagal, the host of the popular NPR News quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You can find more details about his book, The Incomplete Book of Running, and see photos of his visit to our studios by visiting us on Facebook and Twitter at WLRN Sundial. He even signed somebody's shoes, just so you know. Well, that's the program for today, this Wednesday, December 12th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again so much for joining us.